Well, DJ Paul Gambaccini has been a regular broadcaster for the last 40 years, starting on BBC Radio 1 way back in 1973. But last year, his career was suddenly put on hold after being falsely accused of historical sexual abuse as part of the investigation U3. In the wake of the Jimmy Savile revelations, Paul was arrested over alleged historical sex offences against two teenage boys and indeed spent a year on bail. Well, last week, Stephen spoke to him and asked him to take him back to that night in October 2013 when the police came knocking on his door.
Yes. Actually, they don't knock. They ring the bell. It's 4:38. Why do I know that? Because the clock's next to the bed, as all good radio presenters have their clock next to the bed, Stephen.
Yeah.
And the doorbell goes. I look at the clock, 4:38. Was that the doorbell? It rings again. Yes, it was the doorbell. I get up, look through the peephole. It's them. Immediately, I know what it's about.
Why?
Well, I had thought there was a 50-50 chance it might happen because I have one of those mental Polaroids in my mind, although younger listeners won't know what a Polaroid is, but meaning a visual image that stays in your mind for the rest of your life. And it was when I looked at the BBC website and the police had opened a dedicated phone line and a dedicated website and invited the public to accuse celebrities of sexual perversion, saying, "You will be believed." And I thought, well, I've had it, because my picture had been on the front page of several newspapers on two different days next to that of, and the name is going to have to be mentioned at some point in this, Jimmy Savile, because I'd been the first person to speak out against him even before the TV documentary that exposed him. So in this new British justice system, this mutation from the centuries-old objective, evidence-based system to the subjective rumor and accusation-based system, in which you can't have evidence, so they only require people who agree. Well, if they could find two people to agree out of the tens of millions of people who've gotten to know my name over the course of 40 years of broadcasting, then I've had it. Of course, you then waste energy thinking, did I ever have a bad date? Is there someone who has a grudge against me? But in the end, it turns out it's someone you never knew.
You're an incredibly intelligent guy, right? But it's not the smartest things you know to say, to put into the public domain that you thought that they might visit you, because there's a hint in that for those people who do not believe that you were innocent, and you are innocent, and you have always been innocent, but you know there's a hint. You expected them, so they will put two and two together with that. Why are you saying it out loud?
Oh, but I did not say that I feared arrest before I was arrested.
No, but you're saying it now.
Yeah, but I'm trying to tell the honest, true story of what happened. You see, the reason I'm saying this is because the police conduct was so below the standard of what is to be expected in a just society. They had launched an operation that was results-oriented rather than justice-oriented. The result was announced in advance. We are going to round up the pervs, celebrities from the 1970s. Well, this is, if you think about it for more than 3 seconds, pretty random. How about footballers from the 60s or bankers from the 80s? Sexual perversion occurs across professions. And so they over-arrested. Quite simple.
What did they do when they came into your house?
Well, they stream around and they gathered sackloads of materials, which they took for 14 months. I very naively thought they might be back by Christmas. Ha ha. Goodbye to two iMacs and my iPhone. But fortunately, they didn't take the iPad. They didn't recognize this flat gray thing as being a computer. So we were able to write emails that night. But nonetheless, they took away 38 years of my diaries and phone books.
And where are you? Where are you asked to sit in your own home? Or what happens when they walk into your own home? What do they do to you?
I was allowed to press my orange juice and heat up my croissant before they took me away. I was not allowed to shave, but I was allowed to have my little breakfast because they said you wouldn't like the food in the canteen. And I was allowed to go to the toilet, which is a good thing, because when I was kept in the cell, there was no toilet roll. I just give that as a detail because Jim Davidson wrote that in his book as well. When I was reading Davidson's book, I thought, my God, that happened to me too. you never know how your stories are going to jibe. And so then they took me to the police station. My husband, Chris, stayed behind and did something very intelligent. He rang all of our relatives all around the world and said, don't speak to the press. Because, as it turned out, there was an international press attempt to get quotes from my relatives, and all of my relatives around the world were disturbed. My husband Christopher's parents, who live in a small town in Norfolk, got a couple of visits.
So what do they ask you in your first interview? Do they present the evidence? Do they present names? What do they do?
Well, what happens is when your solicitor arrives, they give him the disclosure sheet, as it's called, which lists what you're accused of, and you are allowed to read it. And that's when I read this list of things, which could be summed up in one sentence. I was accused of having sex with two males I've never known in the decade before I even started having same-sex relations. I mean, that's the killer. So much for where were you on the evening of April 23rd. I was accused not only on the wrong day, not only in the wrong year, the Metropolitan Police were in the wrong decade. Really doesn't build confidence. So this was so out. And I was really irritated. It's funny the things you get irritated by. This supposedly happened between 1978 and 1984. Well, I didn't even live at the premises indicated for 25% of that time period. Nice research, guys. So if you take that away, that leaves 1978 to the middle of 1983. Now, this is a same-sex case. If any gay man of a certain age or any social historian had seen that, they would have said within 5 seconds this couldn't have happened.
Why?
Because precisely in the middle of 1983, we had the announcement of the new disease, the disease which became known as AIDS, which took a third of my gay friends. From the publicly known, Freddie Mercury, Kenny Everett, to the unknown, like my darling PA, Terry Gibbons, who was lost in his 20s. And if I and my co-accused, because I did have a co-accused, even though I hadn't been in contact with him for many years, I hadn't seen him, I didn't even have his contact details, but I must assume that his accusations were similar. We were accused of having hardcore sex with these two teenagers for a 6-year period. But those happened to correspond historically to the precise 5 years in which HIV was being transmitted between people who didn't even know the virus existed. If I had done what I was accused to have done, I would be not giving this interview now. I would be dead.
Did they give you their names?
Yes.
And did you even know these people?
No, the names meant nothing to me. And even more frustratingly, they were common names, so you couldn't learn anything from Googling. My husband, Christopher, spent a lot of time in the book. We talk about the wild goose chase we went on trying to find out things about these two people. I was told, for example, for some reason, in addition to the horse riding, when it came to number two, I was told the name of the public school he'd gone to. And so we tried to figure out from his age who else might have been there at that time. So this sets off a series of comic episodes, comic looking back, which we talk about in the book. Why am I saying we? It's me. I wrote this. Anyway, I wrote this book, and I talk about how I try to track down this person. And I write to a prominent Liberal Democrat. I'm not even allowed legally to tell you what Liberal Democrat it was. Because the English law protects false accusers. Not only are you not allowed to name their names, you are not allowed to say anything about them which might help other people deduce their identity. So I can't tell you I figure horse riding in the 1970s, that's pretty innocuous. So it's like saying he had breakfast in the 1970s. But I can't tell you the name of the school he went to because you might somehow track him down. But there was a prominent Liberal Democratic politician who went to the same school in the same decade. So I wrote him and this comic search. But that's the kind of thing you have to do when you find yourself facing the full weight of the state with no financial restrictions and you have no information. And every day you try to figure out a way to counter these allegations, even if it turns out you've wasted your time.
You're a confident guy.
I'm a what guy?
You're a confident guy. You're
Thank
confident.
You. Thank you.
Did that go during this? How much did this mess you up?
Well, there were two ways. I like the expression mess me up. I did have rage attacks. I've said this quite openly because this was my main problem. I had an old friend who was the first to guess that this would be my problem. He quickly sent me an email and recommended that I see somebody about anger management. Well, and I never actually did see anybody about anger management, but I talked it out with a lot of people. Since I never knew these two people, I couldn't feel any kind of remorse whatsoever. The only thing I could feel was anger. And not at them, because I don't know what their state of mind is. I could be angry at the police for taking on such an extraordinarily flimsy case, publicizing me in the media.
So what were they like with you when they were interviewing you? Were they aggressive? Did they try to be friendly while trying to wreck you? Or what was their demeanor?
I make a distinction between the rank-and-file policeman, who I found in 90% of the cases, is a good, honest, hard-working man and woman, with your superior officers who make these good people work on bad cases. And so the people who were interviewing me were quite civil. There was one in particular who acted as you or I would right now, or if we were having dinner. He was doing his job, and he did it well, and I can't criticize him. And I don't criticize him. I criticize the top brass of the Metropolitan Police for what is and will be regarded by history as one of the greatest failures in the history of British policing.
So what do you expect the police to do when someone comes forward and says, Paul Gambaccini has done this to me? What do you expect them to do?
You see, there was no evidence that the police understood the nature of celebrity. The man in the street is known to the people he has met in his life. The celebrity is known to the people he has met in his life and millions of others, for some of whom he has satisfied emotional needs. Almost everyone in public life has had a stalker or a fantasist. In the week after I was arrested, we went out to dinner with Darren Brown, the illusionist, and he said, oh, I've had this. There was a woman who maintained a marital home thinking that we were married, and the only reason I never showed up was I was working too hard. And the police don't seem to realize that when they ask people to condemn celebrities, they will include in that number a number of possible accusers who have never known the person. Now, I say to all people who are genuine victims or representatives of organizations who champion genuine victims, you know I am on your side and always have been. I'm talking about this other class of wrong people which has been created by the witch hunt.
How do people who you love and have befriended over the years treat you?
They say that in times of trial, you find out who your real friends are. But really, we always know who our real friends are. It's just that in circumstances like these, they prove it. And when they do prove it, you feel your love for them. And when you feel that much love, it is greater than the negativity the police throw at you. And that's what gets you through. One of the greatest disappointments, of course, was the BBC. It was a great education to see that all of the radio people and radio executives were on my side, let me know, supported me. But their support was fruitless because the organization's diktat was he must become a non-person. And so not only...
How do you know the organization said that?
Well, when I say they said that, it was the understood policy. I just disappeared across the networks. My Radio 2 contract was canceled. And I wasn't paid anymore, even though I had a year-long contract.
Can they do? Well, obviously they can do it if they did it. But how can they do that legally if you're an innocent man? How can they stop paying you?
Well, there was a loophole in the contract. Because my show on Radio 2 was an independent production, They told the independent producer, we are not going to pay you for any programs that have Paul in them. So therefore, he had to not have me in any programs, and so I couldn't be paid. Now, then there was the case of Radio 4, where a documentary we had prepared for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy had to be pulled. There was a repeat on 4 Extra of a program about the Britain War Requiem that was pulled. I was edited out of a comedy special for Christmas on BBC 4, even though I'd already been paid. So I just became a non-person.
How long, Paul, had you worked for the BBC?
40 years.
Why didn't they stand by you?
Let's put it this way. If John F. Kennedy rose from the grave and wrote a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize-winning book Profiles in Courage, he would not include the upper management of the BBC. I recognize what they perceived to be their problem, but like all bad generals, they were fighting the last war. The last war was Savile. The BBC lost that war. This was a new war. This was an attempt to smear a generation and the BBC through its aging stars. And they didn't seem to have the sense to realize this was a whole new ballgame. And so consequently, they just hid and remained silent. As I say, to this day, I have not had a single communication from any member of BBC upper management, not even to say, what is this about? So you see, don't count on a gold watch, ladies and gentlemen. Love your job because you love doing your job.
If you work for an organization that long, 40 years, you know, the majority of your life, for goodness sake, that must hurt big time.
Well, it lets me know, yes, it lets me know that the BBC has changed utterly from when I started. Because when I began in the 70s, it was people who considered it like the Japanese used to consider their employment. You'd stay there for life. You'd work your way up. But as long as they wanted you, you would be there because you believed in the project. You have to remember David Attenborough had been the controller of BBC Two, who inspired me to want to be on the BBC, because the first thing I ever saw of the BBC was Civilization, the Kenneth Clark series that he had commissioned. We saw that when we were at college in the States. And that kind of leadership in the past 25 years has gone, as it's been replaced by people who go from sector to sector, sometimes even profession to profession. So they're more concerned about the BBC as a step on their individual career ladder rather than the organization to which they give their life, as I have. So there are different loyalties, but that means, as a corollary, they don't know you. This is why the radio people could support me as they did, because they knew me. They'd been working with me for years. They knew and trusted me. And the upper executives don't know me because they've come from different places and they're not BBC people, even though, ironically, they are the BBC management. So, you see, you learn about the very structure and the nature of power within the organization.
And yet you're back on the BBC.
Oh, yes. Yes. You see, the minute I was...
Why be part of an organization that does that to an innocent man?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, of course, the only answer is cynical, but I'm grateful to radio. I will always champion and defend the radio services. They are the finest in the world. TV is another question, and TV has chosen to go tabloid. And as I say in the book... And I hope this doesn't get me into trouble with the top brass, but who cares if it does. When they broadcast the raid on Cliff Richard's house, that was the low point in the history of the British Broadcasting Corporation. They acquiesced in totalitarianism.
Why is it not a legitimate news story when one of the most famous singers in the world is being raided by the police?
Because I knew why they were doing it. You see, the police only had one accuser. They needed a second one to justify an arrest, since, as I said, in this rumor and accusation-based justice system, there can be no evidence. So they wanted to beat the bushes as loudly and as fiercely as they could to try to get more accusers. And so it was arranged for this raid, which was broadcast. And, you know, if BBC News had had the sense to respond to my arrest, not with let's shun him, but yippee, now we have an insider, who can give us all the scoops on Yew Tree and who can tell us who's going to be innocent and who's going to be guilty. But instead of – I would have told them, do not go near the Cliff Richard arrest. Report it, but don't make a big deal about it because this is being done to get another accuser. That's the low point in the history of the BBC. Until 3 weeks later when the upper management went to the BBC House of Commons Home Affairs Select Committee to justify the unjustifiable.
What about we're talking a lot about your professional world here and the professional organisations. So what about when it is so public around you and you walk to the shops, you do ordinary things in life, you want to walk out of the house. What's life like then?
Totally normal. The people of this country are a kind and generous people. They have been since I first came here as a student. And wherever I went around the country during my year on bail, everyone was supportive. No one thought I was a perv. They didn't buy the police line, which I thought was very interesting.
How do they tell you it's all over? What happens?
Oh, your lawyer, ha ha. The three magic words were no further action, although I've been told that since Jim Davidson wrote his book called No Further Action, they've changed it to not proceeding with. And that's all you get. You get either an email to your lawyer, not to you, to your lawyer, or a phone call.
Maybe. Do they apologize?
Never. Never.
Paul, does it irrevocably leave something changed inside you when something like this happens to you? Does it change the chemistry in your brain or how you think about yourself, how you feel?
Well, yes, in two ways. One is, of course, when you are stopped from doing what you are accustomed to doing for a full year, you do other things. And some of those things you will continue to do. Though it may sound laughable, I do more gardening than I ever did, for example. But I really pay attention to my friends, my husband, my godson, my nephew, my niece. I really pay attention to what's happening in their life, and I'll admit far more than I did before. I would like to think that maybe I'm a better man. But also, something terrible has happened to me, and people say, what have you lost? And they start to think about the money, because £200,000 of lost income and legal fees is a lot of money. But I'm back working again. I'll accumulate more money over time. That's not really the important thing. There is something deeper. No one loves a country as much as someone who has chosen to live there. And I was not born in this country. I chose to live here. And this country gave me a quality education, a superior health service when I needed one, and a career of a like of which could not have been dreamt until I lived it. And you know this goes for Ulster too, because in the time of troubles when I would go over as a radio and DJ, I received love from all, not just from one kind of person. All the British people have been generous to me for 45 years, not just the time I've been in radio. And so, of course, I continue to love them. But my unqualified love for Britain has been qualified by my experience with the law enforcement services. And some would say that my view of Britain was always a bit rosy. I would recommend to my American friends that they come to live in Britain because it was a more humane place in which to live. Now I'm a bit more realistic. And although it may be good to be realistic, it's a bit sad to have to let go of a dream. Sorry if that sounds sad, but well, that's the way it is. I can't pretend this didn't happen.
Yeah, but it is sad. It's profoundly sad.
And it lives within me as I watch the witch hunt continue. Cliff Richard eats away at me every day. I will make a promise to you, Stephen. I made this on the television show Loose Women the other day. If Cliff Richard is ever convicted of any offense, down to and including parking fines, I will eat my hat. His continued persecution eats away at me. I'm aware of it every day. This is the country which I recommended to my friends to move to because it was a more humane place in which to live. And I can't make that recommendation anymore. How heartbreaking.
Paul, thank you for speaking to me today. Thank you.
Cheers, Stephen.
There you have it, Paul Gambaccini speaking to Stephen. And just in relation to what Paul had to say about Cliff Richard and the coverage of the raid on his home, a BBC spokesperson said the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee had endorsed its coverage of the Cliff Richard story. Love, Paul Gambaccini. My Year Under Yew Tree is available now.